all except for a short man in starched brown trousers. His round face seemed out of place here, a dark cloud amid the many sunny, adoring expressions. Peggy stopped by Raphael's Holy Family. She pointed from the beardless Joseph to the Virgin, as though discussing them.
"There's a man in brown pants who seems to be watching Volka," she whispered.
"I only saw a woman," George said.
"Where?"
"She's standing in the adjoining room," he said, "the one with the Michelangelo. She's reading her guidebook, facing this room." Peggy pretended to sneeze so that she could turn away from the painting. She saw the woman, her eyes in her book, though she was holding her head very steady and definitely watching Volka with peripheral vision.
"Good catch," Peggy said.
"They've got both exits covered, but that doesn't mean they know who we are."
"Maybe that's why they sent Volka," George said. "They're using him as bait, and he was letting you know that."
A minute had passed, and looking at his watch, Volka began walking away from the painting. The round-faced man began to turn away as Volka approached, but the woman only half-turned. The way she was standing, she could still look into the room. The round-faced man stopped.
"Why did she keep watching?" Peggy wondered aloud, as she and George wandered over to the next painting.
"Maybe our friend Ronash described us to him."
"It's possible," she said. "Let's split up and see what happens."
"That's crazy. Who'll watch our backs?"
"We'll have to watch our own backs," Peggy said.
"You go out behind Volka, and I'll go past the woman. We'll meet in the ground floor main entrance. If one of us gets in trouble, the other gets out of here, agreed?"
"No way," said George. Peggy opened her own guidebook at random.
"Look," she said quietly but firmly, "someone's got to get out and report on what's happened. Describe these people, break them. Don't you see that?"
George thought, that's the difference between a striker and an agent. One is a team player, the other a lone wolf. In this case, however, the lone wolf had a point.
"All right," he said, "agreed."
Peggy looked up from the book and pointed to the room with the Michelangelo. George nodded, glanced at his watch, then pecked her on the cheek.
"Good luck," he said, then set off in the direction Volka had headed.
As George approached the round-faced man, he felt a kind of undertow pulling them together. He kept his face averted, searching the crowd for Volka, as he entered the Loggia of Raphael, a gallery copied from one of the same name in the Vatican. He didn't see the round-faced man as he walked beside the spectacular murals by Unterberger, nor could he find Volka.
"Одну минуту, пожалуйста,"
someone said from behind him. "A moment, please." George turned, his muscles tensing as the round-faced man approached. He understood "please," and gathered from the raised index finger that the man wanted him to wait. Where the conversation would go from here, though, he had no idea. He was smiling pleasantly as, suddenly, Volka came rushing from behind the round-faced man. He'd doffed his windbreaker, which was why George had lost sight of him, and had stretched it tightly between his hands. In one quick motion, he wrapped it around the throat of the round-faced man while he was looking at George.
"Damn you, Pogodin!"
he yelled, his own face turning crimson from the strength he put into the attack. Two security guards from down the hall came running toward Volka, radios pressed to their mouths, calling for support.
"Go!"
Volka gurgled at George. The striker backed toward the entrance to the Western European gallery. He glanced over his shoulder to see if Peggy would come back, and saw that both his partner and the woman were gone. When he looked back at Volka, Pogodin had already drawn a small PSM pistol from inside his jacket. Before George could move, Pogodin had reached around his chest and fired backward at his assailant. He shot just once, and the Russian fell to a knee, and then onto his back, blood pooling at his side. George turned away quickly, and, resisting the urge to go after Peggy and make certain she was safe, he headed toward the magnificent theater staircase and made his way downstairs. As he departed, George was unaware of another pair of eyes that had been watching from behind an archway at the southern end of the gallery, Spetsnaz-trained eyes, as sharp and carnivorous as those of a hawk. Chapter 66. Tuesday, 11:47 p.m., Habarovsk. It moved like Peter Pan's shadow, an ever-changing black shape barely seen against the dark objects below it and the dark sky around it. The matte-black, swept-tip rotors and seamless, round-surfaced fuselage of the Mosquito threw off little reflected light and were ram-coated, covered with radar-absorbing material. The engines made very little sound, and the armored crew seats, shoulder harnesses, lumbar support cushion, seat bucket, and helmets of the two crewmen were also flat black, so they wouldn't be seen inside the cockpit. The helicopter passed without notice over the concrete buildings of small cities and the wood or stone shacks of villages. Inside the cockpit, the radar and full-color topographical displays, working in conjunction with the Circe autopilot, computer-imaged route correction-enabled, helped the pilot adjust to sudden changes, allowing him to avoid other aircraft that might spot them, or to change his course away from peaks that rose higher than the 4,000 feet at which it was flying. A British ship in the Arctic Ocean picked up radio communications from Moscow to Beira, ordering aircraft sent to rendezvous with the train. Co-pilot Iovina's quick calculations using the onboard computer showed that the planes would be reaching the train just as the Mosquito was leaving. Unless the Russians picked up a decent tailwind or the Mosquito slammed into an unyielding headwind, they should get away without being seen. Unless there was a delay, said Pilot Kars. In that case, his orders were to abort the mission and head for the Sea of Japan. The commitment of the Air Force to recovering the strike force was not dictated by compassion, but by the size of the Mosquito's fuel tank. "Coming up," said co-pilot Iovina. Kars looked at the topographic display. The solid images moved and shifted on the 12-inch screen, having been mapped by satellites and translated into point-of-view images by Pentagon computers. Objects as small as large tree branches showed up on the screen. As the helicopter slashed low over a flat-topped hill and ducked down into a valley, the computer map showed the trackbed. "Going to wrap," said Kars, real airspace profile, indicating that he'd be looking out the window instead of using the tactical displays. Kars looked up from the screens and peered through the night vision sensor, with its wide field-of-view forward-looking infrared scanner. Roughly a mile ahead, he saw a fire in the snow and people strung around it. That would be the offloaded crew. He touched a button beside the HUD. All the strikers carried a locator signal in the heels of their shoes. He scanned for the pulse, which was superimposed on an overhead map. Three beeped red in one area, four in another. Kars raised his eyes higher. Behind high hills in the distance, he saw knots of smoke coiling toward the sky. Three of the signals were coming from there. "Got the train," Kars said. Iovino punched coordinates into a keyboard and looked at the topographic display. "The extraction site is 1.5 miles northwest of our current position. Obviously, the team split up." "How are we on time?" the pilot asked. 53 seconds ahead of schedule." Kars began to descend, simultaneously swinging the Mosquito toward the northwest. The aircraft handled like the balsa wood gliders Kars used to throw when he was a kid, slicing the air lightly and cleanly, the silence of the rotors enhancing the sensation. Clearing the walls of the first of three roughly parallel gorges, the pilot leveled off at 500 feet and flew due north. "Trestle sighted," he said as he saw the old iron structure that crossed the three gorges. "Target located," he added when he saw the strikers at the mouth of the trestle. "Contact 46, 45, 44 seconds, Iovino said after punching coordinates into his keypad. Kars looked toward the southeast, saw the churning smoke of the train. "I only see four of the six," Kars said. "Get the lowdown ASAP. "Roger," said Iovino. While Kars sped toward the target, Iovino watched the digital numbers of the countdown clock on his screen. At 7 seconds to contact, he pressed the button that caused the aft hatchway to slide forward into its pocket. That took 1 second. At 5 seconds to contact, the Mosquito slowed, and he touched a second button that caused a roller arm to swing over and a 25-foot-long black ladder to unroll. It deployed in 4 seconds, and the Mosquito glided to a halt 27 feet above the ground. Ishii Honda was the first one on board. Iovina turned toward him. "Where are the others?" the co-pilot asked. "On the train," Honda said as he snuggled into the tight space and helped pull Sandra aboard. "What are they planning to do?" "Get off and meet us," Honda said as he and Sandra both reached down to Pupshaw. Iovina looked at Kars, who nodded to indicate that he'd heard. "What do we gain by meeting them?" Kars asked Iovino. Even before Pupshaw was inside, Iovino was using the computer to calculate the extra fuel it would take to fly to the train as opposed to hovering here and waiting. The one incalculable was when the three strikers would get off the train, but he had to assume that would be before they arrived. "We're better off meeting them," Iovino said as he pressed the buttons that caused the ladder to withdraw and the hatch to shut. Those were battery-controlled and didn't cost anything fuel-wise. An extended ladder with the hatch opened added to the drag of the craft, which did eat into their fuel. "Let's give him a lift," Carr said, keeping the mosquito at 27 feet as he pivoted to the southeast, smooth and delicate as a compass needle, and sped toward the oncoming train. Chapter 67, Tuesday, 8:49 a.m., Washington, D.C.
"What kind of oil can hairy operation are you guys running, Paul?"
Paul Hood looked at the puffy face of Larry Rocklin in his TV monitor. The thinning gray hair was plastered neatly to the side, and the light hazel eyes were angry behind the gold-framed glasses. An unlit cigar moved up and down as the CIA director spoke.
"I have no idea what you're talking about," Hood replied. He looked at the clock on the bottom of the screen. "Just another few minutes until Stryker was safe, and then 2 hours after that until the mosquito was tucked away on a carrier, all evidence of the incursion gone." Rocklin removed the cigar and pointed with it.
"You know, that's why you got that job instead of Mike Rogers," he said. "You got a poker face like Clark Gable and Gone with the Wind. Who, me, Larry, running a covert operation?" "Well, Paul, despite Stephen Veen's noble attempts to try and tell me a satellite was offline, we've got some photos from a Chinese spy sky showing commandos attacking a train. Beijing asked me about it, and unlike you, I really didn't know a damn thing about it. Now, unless some other country has gotten hold of an Il-76T, which the Chinese put at the scene of the crime, and which I happen to know the Pentagon owns, this makes it your operation. The CIC tells my guys they didn't authorize any kind of shooting war over there. They, too, would like to know exactly what you're doing over there. So I repeat, what's going on?"
Hood said casually.
"I'm as mystified as you are, Larry. I was on vacation, you know."
"I know. And you came back fast."
"I forgot how much I loathe L.A., Hood replied.
"Oh, sure. That was it. Everybody hates L.A., so why do they keep going?"
"The well-marked freeways," said Hood.
"Well, how about I ask the president what's going on?" Rocklin said, poking the cigar back into his mouth. "He'll have all the information right there on his desk, right?"
"I wouldn't know," Hood said. "Give me a few minutes to talk to Mike and Bob, and I'll get back to you."
"Sure, Paul," Larry said. "Just remember something. You're new here. I've been at the Pentagon, the FBI, and now here. This isn't the City of Angels, friend. It's the City of Devils. And if you try and pull anyone's tail, you're going to get burned or pitchforked. Understand?"
"Message received and appreciated, Larry," Hood said. "As I said, I'll get back to you."
"Do that," said the CIA director, using the tapered tip of his cigar to punch off his image.
Hood looked over at Mike Rogers. Everyone else had left to attend to departmental business, leaving the director and his deputy to wait for word from the mosquito.
"Sorry you had to hear that," Hood said.
"No sweat," said Rogers.
He was sitting in an armchair, his arms crossed, his brow creased.
"You don't have to worry about him, though. We've got photos. That's why he has to bluster so damn much. He doesn't really carry a lot of weight."
"What kind of photos?" Hood asked.
"Of him on a boat with three women who weren't his wife," Rogers said. "The only reason the president replaced Greg Kidd with him is that Larry had wiretaps of the president's sister trying to hold a Japanese company up for under-the-table campaign contributions."
"That lady's a piece of work," Hood smiled.
"President Lawrence should have given the CIA to her instead of Larry. At least she'd have used it to spy on our enemies instead of on us."
"Like the man said," Rogers told him, "this is purgatory. Everyone's an enemy here."
The phone beeped. Hood thumbed the speaker button.
"Yes?"
"Incoming from Stryker," said Bugs. Rogers jumped over.
"Private Honda reporting in,"
said a clear voice from a sea of quiet.
"I'm here, Private," said Rogers.
"Sir, myself, Pups, and Sandra are on board the extraction craft."
Rogers felt his gut tighten.
"The other three are still on the train. We don't know why they haven't stopped yet."
Rogers relaxed slightly.
"Any indication of resistance?"
"There doesn't appear to be," said Honda. "We can see them moving in the windows of the cab. I'll keep the line open. Contact in 39 seconds.
Rogers' hands were fists, and he leaned on them as he stood beside the desk. Hood's hands were folded beside the phone, and he took the opportunity to pray for Stryker. Hood looked at Rogers. The general raised his eyes to meet the director's. Hood could see the pride and concern in those eyes, understood the strength of the union between these men, a union deeper than love, closer than marriage. Hood envied Rogers that bond, even now, when it was causing him so much concern. Especially now, Hood thought, for those fears made the bond even stronger. And then Honda's voice came back on, with an edge that hadn't been there moments before. Chapter 68. Tuesday, 4:54 p.m., St. Petersburg. The distance between Peggy and the main entrance of the Hermitage couldn't have been greater if she were still in Helsinki. At least that was how the English operative felt, as she walked briskly toward the next gallery to the south, paintings of the School of Bologna. From there, if she could make it, the walk to the state staircase was a short one. Peggy knew the woman was following her, and would also have backup, someone who would be watching and reporting back to a command center, perhaps the one right here in the Hermitage, operating with or without Orloff's approval. Peggy stopped to look at a painting by Tintoretto just to see what her stalker would do. She watched her intently as though she wore a fingerprint under a magnifying glass. The woman paused in front of a Veronese. There was no play acting. She stopped abruptly, obviously, wanting Peggy to know that she was being followed. Perhaps, Peggy thought, the woman was hoping she would panic. Concentration put two little creases above her nose. Peggy considered and rejected a number of options, from taking a painting hostage to starting a fire. Counterattacks like those invariably brought more forces to the scene and made escape less likely. She even contemplated trying to reach the TV studio and surrender to General Orloff, but she quickly rejected that idea. Even if he was willing to arrange a spy swap, Orloff wouldn't be able to ensure her safety. Besides, the first lesson fifth columnists learned was never to box themselves in, and that basement was more than just a box. It was an already buried coffin. Peggy knew, though, that she wouldn't be allowed to run for long. Now that she and George had been spotted, exits would be closed to them, then corridors, and finally galleries. And then they would be boxed in. Peggy'd be damned if she was going to let the Russians control the time and place of their confrontation. The thing to do was to blind them until she could get out of here, or at the very least, draw their attention away from Private George. And the best way to do that was to start with the art connoisseur on her tail. Peggy wondered what would happen if she offered herself to the woman in a way that was just too inviting to refuse, before the Russians were all in place and ready to receive her. Turning suddenly from the Tintoretto, Peggy began walking briskly, nearly jogging toward the state staircase. The woman followed, keeping pace with her quarry. Peggy hurriedly rounded the corner of the gallery and reached the magnificent staircase, with its walls of yellow marble and two first-floor rows of 10 columns each. Starting down the steps, the Englishwoman knit her way through the sparse late-afternoon crowd, headed toward the ground floor. And then, halfway down, she slipped and fell. Chapter 69, Tuesday, 11:55 p.m., Khabarovsk. It had been 2 minutes before Squires had planned to stop the train when the Russian officer said, "Cigarette." The strikers had been standing in the cab of the train, securing their gear, when Squires looked down. "We don't smoke," the striker commander had said. "It's the new army. You got any on you?" The Russian didn't understand. "Cigarette," he said. He used his chin to point to his left breast. Squires had looked back out the window as the train went into a gentle curve. He slipped down his night vision goggles. "Neumeyer," he'd said. "See if you can help the man." "Yes, sir," the private had replied. Leaving the wounded Sergeant Gray in the corner, Neumeyer had bent over the Russian. He'd reached into the officer's jacket and withdrawn a worn leather packet of tobacco with a thick rubber band holding it closed. A steel lighter with Cyrillic initials and an engraved portrait of Stalin was tucked under the rubber band. "Must be an heirloom," Neumeyer had said, glancing at the engraving in the ruddy light of the cab. Neumeyer had then opened the pouch, found several rolled cigarettes inside, and removed one. Nikita had extended his tongue, and Neumeyer placed it on the end. The Russian pulled the smoke between his lips and accepted a light. Neumeyer had closed the top of the lighter and put everything back together with the rubber band. Nikita blew twin clouds of smoke from his nostrils. Neumeyer bent close to replace the tobacco pouch. As the striker had leaned over their prisoner, Nikita suddenly bent forward at the waist, butting his forehead into Neumeyer's head. With a moan, Neumeyer fell back and dropped the pouch. Sitting up and grabbing it, the Russian used the heel of his hand to cram the pouch and lighter into the gears of the throttle. Then, as Neumeyer made a belated lunge for him, Nikita quickly pushed the iron lever away from him. The train had sped up as the gears chewed down on the pouch and on the lighter his father had given him. Strips of leather and chunks of steel infuse the gears, bending the teeth, locking them in a disfigured embrace.
Shit!
Squires had said as Neumeier fell back, holding his hand. The officer had gone to the throttle and tried to push it in the opposite direction, but it refused to yield.
Shit!
He'd repeated. Squires had glanced then from the Russian's untriumphant expression with eyes that seemed distant, out of focus, to Neumeier. The private wasn't even rubbing his head, which showed the beginnings of a nasty bruise. He was crouched with a knee on the Russian's chest, and a look of self-loathing.
"I'm very sorry, sir," had been all he could think to say.
Well, hell, Squires had thought. The son of a bitch Russian was only doing what we'd have done, and he did it right. And now the train was a runaway, building speed as it cleared the curve and headed toward the trestle. There was no time to gather up Gray and the Russian and jump off before they reached the gorge. And they had just about 2 minutes before the locomotive ceased to exist. Squires jumped back to the window and peered down the track. On the horizon he saw what looked like a cloud of locusts in the green glow of the goggles. It was the extraction craft, though it wasn't like any chopper he'd ever seen. From the smooth lines and color, he knew at once that it was a low observable. He was flattered. Even Muammar Gaddafi hadn't raided the debut of a stealth aircraft, though they'd all been on alert when Reagan and Weinberger crossed his line of death in the Gulf of Sidra and blackened the eyes of Tripoli back in 1986. The helicopter was coming at them fast and low. The snow had stopped completely, visibility was good, and it probably wouldn't take long for the pilot to figure out that the train couldn't be stopped. The question was there enough time for them to be extracted some other way?
Neumeier, Squire said. Help Gray to the roof. We're getting out of here.
Yes, sir, the crestfallen Stryker replied. Rising from the Russian, Neumeier avoided his oddly detached gaze as he went over to Gray, bent beside him, and carefully hefted the sergeant onto his shoulder. The barely conscious noncom did his best to hold on as Neumeier rose. Then the private watched, more alert now, as Squires twisted the Russian onto his chest.
Go,
Squires said to Neumeier, pointing to the door with his forehead.
I'll be okay.
Reluctantly, Neumeier kicked the door open, pulled himself up onto the bottom of the window, and gently eased Gray to the flat roof of the cab. Grabbing a fistful of the Russian's hair, Squires reached back, undid the repelling belt that had kept him on the floor, tied it tightly around his wrists, and walked him toward the door. Chapter 70, Tuesday, 4:56 p.m., St. Petersburg. When she first saw the spy's surprising twist on the stairs, Valya thought that she intended to shoot her, and her instinct was to duck. The Russian started to go down, but when she realized that the spy was falling, Valya checked herself and darted after her. It was always surprising what one could get from a wounded or dying individual. Often their guard was down, or they were so dazed that they said things, sometimes important things. Guests gasped but stood aside as the woman rode down the 20 or so steps on her shoulder, appearing not to hit her head, then reaching the landing with an awkward somersault over one shoulder onto her side. She lay moaning in a fetal position, her legs moving weakly as visitors gathered around. One called to a guard for assistance while two others knelt, one of them doffing his jacket and slipping it under her head.
"Don't touch her!"
Valya yelled.
"Get away!"
The Russian reached the bottom of the stairs and pulled a snub-nosed pistol from an ankle holster.
"This woman's a wanted criminal," she said. "Leave this matter in our hands."
The Russians backed away quickly. The foreigners saw the gun and did likewise. Valya hopped over Peggy so that she was facing her. Then she looked up at the stragglers.
"I said leave!"
Valya shrilled and swept outward with the back of her hand.
"Go!"
The last of the gawkers did, and Valya looked back at Peggy. The spy's eyes were shut, and her right arm was under her chest, her hand against but under her chin. Her left arm was limp at her side. Valya didn't care what might be broken or damaged inside of her. Holding the gun under the woman's chin, Valya rolled her onto her back. Peggy winced, her mouth formed a pained little oval, and then she relaxed again.
"That was an unpleasant fall," Valya said in English. "Can you understand me?"
With apparent effort, Peggy nodded a little.
"You British are dropping like autumn leaves," Valya said. "First I terminated the comic book publisher and his team, now you."
Valya pushed the mouth of the gun into the soft flesh under Peggy's throat.
"I'll see that you get to a hospital," she said, "after we talk."
Peggy's lips moved.
Be... before.
No, no, said Valya with a wicked grin.
After. I want to know some things about your operation first. For instance, in Helsinki, what was the name of...
Peggy moved so quickly that Valya didn't have time to react. She raised the closed fist that had been resting on her chin, the fist in which she held her lapel knife. The blade was pointing down, and Peggy jammed it into the depression above Valya's clavicle and tore inward toward the larynx. At the same time, she used the elbow of her left hand to push Valya's other arm to the floor in case the gun discharged. It didn't. The Russian woman released the gun and grabbed desperately at Peggy's fist with both of her hands, scratching vainly to dislodge the knife.
What I was going to say, Peggy sneered, was before you worry about taking me to hospital, make sure the fall was an accident.
She pushed the knife harder, and Valya gurgled and slumped to her side.
That agent you killed was my Autumn Leaf, she added, and this is for him.
Don't move!
A voice shouted in Russian from the top of the staircase. Peggy looked up at a slender, ascetic-looking man in the uniform of a Spetsnaz colonel. At the end of his outstretched, very steady arm was a P-6 silent pistol. Behind him, still gasping and rubbing his throat, was the man Volka had attacked.
I'm going to get out from under your friend, Peggy replied in Russian.
She had turned her side to throw Valya off. The woman's eyes were shut, and her face was white as her life poured haphazardly onto the marble floor. The colonel was walking down the steps behind his firearm. Peggy dumped Valya onto her back and rose, her own back to the steps.
Arms up,
the officer said to her. If he felt any remorse about Peggy's victim, she didn't hear it in his voice.
I know the drill,
Peggy said, turning wearily as she started to raise her hands. When they were chest high, she turned suddenly, holding the snub-nosed pistol she'd picked up when she threw Valya over. There were no tourists in the way as she fired at Colonel Roski, who stopped where he was, 7 steps up, and took her salvo as if he were in a duel. He met it with fire of his own. Peggy didn't stay where she was. Immediately after firing her short burst, she threw herself to the left, onto the ground, and rolled until she hit the banister. After several seconds, the echoing gunfire stopped, and only a pungent, rising, rapidly thinning tester of smoke remained of the exchange. That, and the crawling red stains on the front of Colonel Roski's uniform. The officer's expression didn't change. His breed had been trained to suffer pain in silence. But after a moment, the extended arm wavered, the P-6 fell to the floor, and then Roski followed it, doing a delicate turn as he dropped to his back. His arms splayed, head facing down, the Spetsnaz warrior slid to the landing, where he came to a stop beside Valya. Peggy trained her pistol on Pogodin, who had been crouching at the top of the staircase behind the ornate newel. She had seen him kill Volka, and he deserved to die, but he seemed to read her thoughts, or perhaps saw the promise of death in her eyes, and broke suddenly from the staircase, running back toward the gallery. Peggy heard the distant clatter of running feet. Whether it was security, panicked tourists, or even strikers, itching for a fight, she had no idea. But as much as she wanted Volka's killer dead, there wasn't time to chase him. Turning, Peggy tucked the gun inside her shirt and ran down the stairs, screaming in Russian,
"Help! The killer is up here! He's a madman!"
As security forces pushed past her, she hurried, still shrieking, through the main entrance. There, Peggy quieted as she lost herself among the strikers who had crowded inside, hoping that it wasn't one of their own, or a government plant pretending to be one of their own, who had gone berserk. Chapter 71, Tuesday, 8:57 a.m., Washington, D.C.
"They're climbing to the roof of the engine,"
Honda said, his lazing-in-the-sun calmness gone, replaced by what sounded to Rogers like fear or horror.
"The thing's going like a torpedo. A runaway, it looks like."
"Can't they get off?" Rogers asked.
"Negative, sir. The train's just starting over the bridge now, and there's nowhere to exit except straight down a couple 100 feet. I can see Gray. Shit. Sorry, sir. Neumeyer just laid him on top of the cab and followed him up. The sergeant is moving, but he seems to be hurt."
"How hurt?" Rogers asked urgently.
"I can't tell, sir. We're too low, and he's lying down. Now I see... I don't know who it is. A Russian soldier, it looks like. He's definitely hurt. There's a great deal of blood on his leg."
"What's the Russian doing?" Rogers asked.
"Not much. Lieutenant Colonel Squires is handing him out to Neumeyer, holding him by the hair. Neumeyer is trying to get his hands under the Russian's arms. Looks like he's struggling. Hold on, sir.
There was talk in the helicopter, and Private Honda was quiet for several seconds. Rogers couldn't make any of the conversation out. Then, near the radio, Rogers heard Sandra say,
"Then we'll jettison our clothes or weapons. We'll make up the weight."
Obviously, Squires was planning to bring the Russian on board, and the pilot was justifiably concerned. Roger's undershirt began to dampen along his spine. Honda came back on.
"The pilot's concerned about 200 added pounds and about how long it's going to take us to get them on board. If he doesn't try to get them, he's going to have a revolt on his hands."
"Private," said Rogers, "this is the pilot's mission now, and he's got a crew to worry about, too. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir."
They were the toughest words Rogers had ever had to utter, and Hood gave the general a reassuring squeeze on the forearm.
"The Russian's torso is out of the train," Honda continued, "but he looks like dead weight."
"But he's not dead?"
"No, sir. His hands and head are moving."
The line was silent again. Rogers and Hood looked at one another, aborted vacations and who answered to who forgotten as they suffered this wait together.
"I can see the lieutenant colonel now," said Honda. "He's leaning out the window, and his hands holding up the front of the Russian's coat. He's motioning, pointing to the cab, moving his finger across his throat."
"The controls are dead," Rogers said. "Is that it?"
"We think that's what he's saying," said Honda. "Hold on, sir. We're about to make a pass over the train, and then I think..." "Yes, sir."
"What, Private?"
With rising excitement, Ishii Honda said,
"Sir, the pilot told us to lower the ladder. We've got 80 seconds to reel our boys in."
Rogers was finally able to breathe. And as he took each breath, he watched the numbers of the computer clock flick by inexorably. Chapter 72. Tuesday, 11:57 p.m., Khabarovsk. The mosquito had slashed overhead like a time-lapse thundercloud, dark, powerful, and silent. Squires followed the helicopter with his eyes as it passed the engine and coal tender, then stopped, pivoted 180 degrees, and began inching back toward them. The ladder dropped fast and straight, and Sandra came down several rungs. Holding tightly to one, she leaned back, her arms stretched down, ready to help.
"Come on!"
she cried.
"No more!"
Squires yelled over the roar of the engine.
"Sir! Let go of the Russian and get Gray out of here! You too!"
Neumeier obeyed without hesitation. Like any special forces team, the strikers had been trained to take orders implicitly and immediately in a crisis situation, however those orders went against their instincts or emotions. Later, when he thought about it over and over, Neumeier would Monday morning quarterback the entire evacuation process, whether he was in bed, drilling, or talking to psychologist Liz Gordon. Now, though, he did what Lieutenant Colonel Squires had ordered. Releasing the Russian, Neumeier put his shoulder back under Gray. The helicopter arrived directly overhead as he stood, the pilot coming down a foot to bring the bottom of the ladder level with Neumeier's knees. The private put his foot on the second rung and began to climb. As soon as he was within range, both Sandra and Private Pupshaw reached down to haul Gray in. Even as she allowed Pupshaw to finish bringing the sergeant inside and extended her hand to Neumeier, Sandra's eyes were on Lieutenant Colonel Squires.
30 seconds,
co-pilot Iovina called back at them.
Sir,
she shouted as he tried to get himself under Nikita.
Half-minute warning! 25,
Iovina shouted. Squires let go of the Russian's hair, hoisted him onto his shoulder, then sat on the edge of the window. As he struggled to get to his feet, Nikita pushed at him, trying to get back in the cab.
20!
Damn you, Squires hissed, grabbing the back of the Russian's coat as Nikita slumped back into the cab. Nikita hooked his arm around the handle beside the window and held on tight.
15!
Sandra's face and voice were beginning to show the strain.
Lieutenant Colonel, 15 seconds!
Still standing in the window, Squires motioned for the chopper to come over to the side. The mosquito edged east, and the pilot descended slightly so the ladder was level with Squires. Squires gestured for him to come a little lower.
10 seconds!
Releasing Nikita's coat, the lieutenant colonel held onto the top of the train with his left hand, while with his right he unholstered his Beretta, pointed it at the top of Nikita's arm, and fired. The Russian howled, lost his hold on the handle, and fell back into the cab. Squires jumped in after him.
No!
Sandra shouted, and scampered down the ladder. Neumeier ran down after her.
5 seconds!
Iovina yelled.
Wait!
Sandra screamed up at him. The ladder was hanging directly beside the window of the cab. Grunting and swearing, Squires pushed the limp Nikita out the window. Sandra and Neumeier both got a hand on his coat and yanked him out. The pilot waited as Pupshaw reached out and helped Neumeier as the Russian was passed up the ladder. The lieutenant colonel clambered back into the window. The instant her hands were free, Sandra reached toward him. His hand came out. The first cargo car exploded, followed a heartbeat later by the second. The blasts caused the engine to hop violently, the back end rising higher than the nose, separating from the coal tender, which bucked up, coal flying and pinwheeled to the west, snapping free of the engine. When it slammed down, the engine was slightly off the track.
"Lieutenant Colonel!"
Sandra cried as Squires fell back into the cab and the pilot pushed the helicopter up and ahead to stay clear of the blast.
"Captain, don't leave yet!"
The pilot raced north and climbed to clear of the shrapnel.
"Get back in!"
Neumeier cried to her, his voice cracking. Sandra's eyes reflected the raging red fireballs as she watched the engine skid forward on the tracks, racing ahead of the blast at an angle, the wheels kicking up sparks and smoke.
"He's still in there,"
she said through her teeth.
"We have to go back."
And then the blast-weakened trestle folded under the engine and the stalled, helpless caboose. The collapse seemed surreal, occurring in slow motion and speeding up only when the fires of the explosion caused the boiler to explode. The blast sent pieces of the locomotive flying up, down, and sideways, dark shards, riding the red and black fireball. And then all of it, the tracks and iron supports, the shattered train and trailing scarves of flame, tumbled into the gorge. The fires shrank to flamelets as the mosquito knifed away through the cold skies.
"No,"
Sandra was saying over and over as strong hands reached down and grasped her shoulders.
"We've got to bring the ladder in,"
Iovina yelled back. Neumeier looked down at Sandra.
"Come back in,"
he cried over the howl of the wind.
"Please."
Sandra climbed into the helicopter, helped along by Neumeier and Pupshaw. As soon as she was inside, Honda reeled in the ladder, and the hatch slid shut. His expression somewhere short of homicidal, Pupshaw used his first aid kit to tend to Gray, then went over to the Russian. Except for Nikita's moans, the silence in the mosquito was awful and absolute.
"He was right there,"
Sandra said at last.
"Just a few more seconds, that's all I needed."
"The pilot was giving them to you," Neumeier said. "It was the explosion."
"No,"
she said.
"I lost him."
"That's not true," said Neumeier. "There was nothing you could have done," she snapped.
"I could have done what my guts told me to. Shot the bastard he was trying to save. We made our flying wait,"
she said bitterly, then turned her glazed eyes toward the Russian. "And if it were up to me, we'd lose even more weight." Then, as though repulsed by her own inhumanity, she said,
"Oh, God, why?"
and turned away. Beside her, Neumeier wept into the sleeve of his coat as Pupshaw bound Nikita's arm and leg as carefully and gently as his sorely tested charity would allow. Chapter 73, Tuesday, 9:10 a.m., Washington, D.C. Ishihanda's voice was thick and slow and weighed on Rogers from his soul out.
"Neumeier and Sergeant Gray were rescued from the train," he said, choking, "along with a Russian officer. We were not able to extract Lieutenant Colonel Squires. He remained..."
Honda stopped, and Rogers could hear him swallow.
"He remained on the train, which has been destroyed. Our mission has been accomplished."
Rogers was unable to speak. His throat, his mouth, his arms were paralyzed. His spirit, accustomed to the suddenness with which battle could snatch away life, was still deadened by what he'd just heard. Hood asked, "How is Sergeant Gray?"
"He took a bullet in the shoulder, sir,"
said Honda. "And the Russian?"
"Hit in the thigh and grazed in the arm,"
Honda answered.
"Because of the fuel situation, we can't put him down. He'll have to come with us to Hokkaido."
"Understood," Hood said. "We'll sort all that out with the Russian embassy."
"Private," said Rogers, his eyes damp, "tell the team that I gave them the impossible to do. And they did it. Tell them that."
"Yes, sir,"
said Honda.
"Thank you, sir. I'll tell them, over and out."
Hood shut the speaker and looked at Rogers. "Is there anything I can do, Mike?" After a moment, the general said,
"Can you get them to give Charlie back and take me?"
Hood didn't answer. He just clasped Rogers' wrist. The general didn't seem to feel it.
"He had a family," Rogers said. "What do I have?"
"A responsibility," Hood replied softly but firmly. You've got to hold yourself together so you can tell that family what happened and help them through this. Rogers turned toward Hood.
Yes, he said. You're right.
I'll call Liz, Hood said. She can help. She'll also have Stryker to deal with when they get back.
Stryker,
Rogers started, choked.
I have to see to that. If they have a mission tomorrow, someone's got to be ready to lead it.
Get Major Shooter to start the process, Hood said. Rogers shook his head and rose.
No, sir. That's my job. I'll have recommendations to discuss with you by this afternoon.
Very good, Hood said. Bob Herbert rolled in then, breaking his wheelchair and swinging toward the men. He was grinning broadly.
Just got word from the Pentagon this second, he said. They listened to the Russian aircraft as they flew over the target area. The pilots spotted the offloaded Russians, saw the wrecked train, and didn't catch so much as a glimpse of the extraction craft.
He clapped once as though his hands were cymbals.
How's that for low observability?
Rogers looked at him. Herbert's smile froze as their eyes met.
We lost Charlie, the general said.
Herbert's smile fluttered, then crashed.
Oh, man. Man,
he said. Lines appeared in his forehead, and his ruddy cheeks paled.
Not Charlie.
Bob, said Hood, we need you to help us tie this up with the Russians. One of their officers is on the extraction craft. We'd prefer if he could be snuck out of...
Paul, are you effing crazy?
Herbert yelled. He rolled forward menacingly.
Give me a second to swallow this shit.
No, Rogers said in a firm voice. Paul is absolutely right. We're not finished yet. Lowell has to inform Congress about what's happened. Martha has to work her charms on the Russians. The President has to be briefed, and if the press finds out about this, as I'm sure they will, Anne will have to deal with them. We can mourn later. Right now, we've all got work to do. Herbert looked from Rogers to Hood. The red from his face had pooled over his collar.
Yeah, right. He turned his chair around. Gotta keep the wheels of government spinning, with blood for oil. Nobody did much for me either when I got half blown up. Why should Charlie be any different?
Because this is what would have made him feel like he hadn't died for nothing,
Rogers shouted at Herbert's back.
We'll honor Charlie Squires, I promise you.
Herbert stopped, and his head slumped forward.
Yeah, I know, he said without turning. It just hurts like a bitch, you know?
I know,
Rogers said quietly as tears finally spilled from his eyes.
I surely do know that.
Chapter 74. Tuesday, 4:15 p.m., Moscow. 5 minutes after the Pentagon intercepted the communication from the Russian jets to their base, Interior Minister Dugin received a call from Air Force General Daka's office.
Mr. Minister, said the caller, this is General Major Dragoon. The intercept craft you requested found no sign of foreign aircraft, only military and civilian passengers from the train.
Then the team must still be down there, Dugin said.
Moreover, Dragoon persisted, the general has asked me to inform you that a train you commandeered in Vladivostok has been spotted at the bottom of the Obyarnaya Gorge, east of Khabarovsk.
In what condition?
Dugin asked, even though he knew the answer.
Damn Orlov and his team, he knew.
Dragoon replied, the train has been destroyed, utterly.
Dugin's mouth opened as though he'd been punched. It was several moments before he could draw breath to speak.
Let me talk to the general,
he croaked.
Unfortunately, said Dragoon, General Daka is in a meeting with representatives of President Zhanyin. It will be quite some time before they're finished.
Would there be a message, Mr. Minister?
Dugin shook his head slowly.
No, General Major. There will be no message.
Very good, Dragoon said. Good afternoon, sir.
Dugin slashed the cradle with the side of his hand. It's over, he thought. All of it. his plans, his dreams, his new Soviet Union. And when Shovich learned that his money had been lost, his life would be over as well. Dugin lifted his hand. When he heard a dial tone, he buzzed his assistant and asked him to get Sergei Orlov on the phone. Or will he avoid me too? Dugin wondered. Maybe the Soviet Union had returned, though not in the way he'd expected. Orlov came on immediately.
I was about to phone you, Minister. There's been a shootout in the museum. Colonel Roski is in very critical condition, and one of his operatives, Valya Saparov, has been slain.
The perpetrator?
An agent who came in via Helsinki, said Orlov. She escaped into a crowd of striking workers. The militia is looking for her now.
He hesitated.
Do you know about the train, Minister?
I do, said Dugin.
Tell me, Sergei, have you heard from your son?
Olaf's voice was cosmonaut professional.
There has been no communication with the people from the train. I know they were taken off, but I don't know about Nikita.
I believe he's all right, Dugin said confidently. There's been so much carnage, like in Stalingrad.
Yet one or two flowers always survive.
I hope you're right, said Orlov.
Dugin took a deep breath, trembled letting it out.
I appear to be one of the casualties. General Kosygin, perhaps General Mavik, the ones who didn't stay to the rear. The only question is who will get to us first, the government, Shovich, or the Colombians who gave the money to him. If you go to Zhanin, you can request protection.
Against Shovich, Dugin snickered. In a country where 100 American dollars can buy an assassin?
No, Sergei.
My fortune's burned with the train.
It's ironic, though.
I hated the gangster and everything he stood for.
Then why, Minister, did you ever get involved with him? Why did so many people have to suffer?
I don't know, Dugin replied. Honestly, I don't. General Kosygin convinced me we could move him aside later, and I wanted to believe that, though I never did, I suppose.
His eyes ranged over the old maps on his walls.
I wanted this so very much, to bring back what we've lost, to return to the time when the Soviet Union acted and other nations reacted, when our science and culture and military might was the envy of the world. I suppose, in retrospect, this was not the way to do it.
Minister Dugin, said Orlov, it could not have been done.
Had you built this new union, it would have fallen.
When I returned to the space center in Kazakhstan last month, I saw the bird droppings and feathers on the staircases, and the boosters covered with plastic that was covered with dust. And I ached for a return to the past as well, to the era of Gagarin and the time when our space shuttles, the Burans, were going to allow us to colonize space. We cannot prevent evolution and extinction, Minister. And once it has occurred, we cannot reverse it.
Perhaps, said Dugin. But it is in our nature to fight. When a man is dying, you do not ask if a treatment is too expensive or too dangerous. You do what you feel must be done. Only when the patient has died and reason has replaced emotion do you see how impossible the task was.
He smiled.
And yet, Sergei, yet I must admit that for a time I thought I was going to succeed. If not for the Americans...
No, said Dugin.
Not the Americans. It was just one American. An FBI agent in Tokyo who fired at the jet and forced us to transfer the money. Think of it, Sergei. It's humbling to think that one unassuming soul changed the world where the mighty failed.
Dogin was breathing easier now. He felt oddly at peace as he reached to the right and opened his top desk drawer.
I hope you will stay on at the center, Sergei. Russia needs people like you. And your son, when you see him, don't be too rough with him. We wanted to recapture what we once had, and he wanted to see it for the first time outside the history books. Though the methods may have been questionable, there was no shame in the dream.
Replacing the receiver, Dogin looked at the map of the Soviet Union in 1945, and continued to look at it through clear eyes as he put the barrel of the Makarov against his temple and pulled the trigger. Chapter 75, Tuesday, 4:22 p.m., St. Petersburg. It seemed strange to General Orlov that the three men who had had such key roles in the day's events, Dogin, Paul Hood, and himself, had conducted their business from desks, had not seen daylight since the crisis began. Devils in the dark we are, conducting the affairs of men. There was only one thing Orlov had to do, and he couldn't do it. Not yet. Having called General Daka's office to request news of his son and the rest of Nikita's command, all he could do was sit and think and wait. He let his body sink back into the chair, his arms on the rests, hands hanging over the front and seeming to weigh so very much. Olaf had been forced to fight his own countrymen, all of whom loved Russia in their own way, and now the tragedy of what had happened, and his part in it, began to weigh on him. He bent his head toward his watch, promptly forgot what time it was. Why hasn't anyone called, he wondered. Surely the pilots had been able to ascertain how many soldiers were on the ground. The beep of the phone startled him, like the hiss of a coiled snake. But it brought him to life, and he grabbed the receiver before the first beep had died.
Yes?
His temple was beating against the earpiece. His secretary said,
There's a video call for you.
Send it, Orlov said urgently. Orlov's eyes were on the monitor as Paul Hood's face came on. The American took a moment to ascertain that it was Orlov he was looking at.
General, Hood said, your son is all right.
Orlov's jaw trembled for a moment, then he smiled with relief.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
He's in the extraction craft, Hood continued, and we'll arrange for his safe return as soon as possible. That may take a day or two, since he was wounded slightly in the arm and leg.
But he's all right. In no danger.
We're taking good care of him, said Hood. Orlov slumped forward slightly, his body relaxing with the good news. But there was something in the American's eyes, a hollowness in his voice, that suggested something else was wrong.
Is there anything I can do for you?
Orlov asked.
Yes, said Hood, there is. I want you to tell your son something.
Orlov rose attentively on his elbows.
Your son did his best to resist extraction. I'm sure he thought it was his duty to go down with the ship, or perhaps it was a point of honor not to leave on an enemy craft. But in so doing, he caused the death of my team commander. I'm deeply sorry, Orlov said. Is there anything I can do to...
General, Hood interrupted, I'm not selling guilt or asking for anything. We'll reclaim the remains through diplomatic channels. But my second-in-command was very close to the team leader, and he wanted you to relay something to your son.
Of course, said Orlov.
He says that in the Russian folktale Sutko, the Tsar of the Sea tells the hero that any warrior can take lives, but a truly great warrior struggles to spare them. Make sure your son understands that. Help him to be a great warrior.
I've not had great success convincing my son of anything, Orlov said, but I give you my word. Great warriors will grow from the seeds that have been sown here.
Orlov thanked Hood again, and then the general signed off and thought in respectful silence about the nameless, faceless man, but for whom his own life and the life of his wife would now be a shambles. and then he got up from his desk and took his hat from the rack and went outside. Except for the dwindling crowd of protesting workers, the day looked exactly like it had when he arrived, and he was startled to realize that exactly 24 hours had passed since he'd arrived for the showdown with Roski. 24 hours since the world nearly changed, and 24 hours since he had hugged his wife. Chapter 76, Tuesday, 10 p.m., Helsinki. It was easy for Peggy to get out of the Hermitage. When the shots were fired in the staircase, rumors erupted among the striking workers that the army was coming and the gathering was going to be broken up. The crowd quickly began to disperse, then rejoined almost as fast, like mercury, when police began to rush inside and leaders realized that the gunplay had nothing to do with them. The mass of workers then sloshed toward the Hermitage, clogging the main entrance where there were no longer any guards, walking and tripping inside, causing panic among tourists trying to get out, and drawing the guards back again. They used nightsticks and rigid forearms, hands pressed knuckle to knuckle to protect the art and drive the strikers back. Peggy left as a panicked tourist. The day was growing dark, and once outside, Peggy made her way to the Nevsky metro stop. It was crowded with rush-hour commuters, but the trains came every 2 minutes, and paying her 5 kopecks, she was able to leave shortly after arriving. From there, it was a short run across the Neva to the Finland station, which made stops in Roslev, Riepino, Viborg, and Finland. Private George was already there, sitting on a wooden bench in the waiting room, reading an English-language newspaper, a plastic bag of souvenirs at his side. She watched him after showing her visa and passport at the ticket window and purchasing passage to Helsinki. He would read for a minute, look up and around for a few seconds, then read again. Once he looked up for several seconds longer than usual. Not at her, but she was certainly in his range of vision. Afterwards, he got up and walked away with his newspaper and postcards and Hermitage snow globe and other mementos. That was to let her know he had seen her and wouldn't be watching any more. Once he was gone, Peggy walked over to the central kiosk and bought English and Russian newspapers of her own, several magazines, and sat down to await the midnight departure of the train. Security was no tighter than usual at the train station, events in Moscow and Ukraine obviously consuming the resources and attention of the rank-and-file militia. Peggy boarded the train without incident after presenting her credentials and leave papers at the gate. The train was a modern one, brightly lit with faux plush seats in the coach, which were narrow but soft, to make unsophisticated travelers think they were riding in high style. Though Peggy couldn't stand the ambiance here, or among the crushed red and yellow velvets of the lounge car, neither her aesthetic disapproval nor the pressure of the last few hours showed on her relaxed features. Only when she was in the airplane-style restroom, checking her clothes and flesh for spots of the dead woman's blood, did she allow herself a moment of release. She leaned on her hands on the stainless steel sink, shut her eyes, and said in a voice below a whisper, "I did not go to seek vengeance, but it's mine, and I'm comforted by it." She smiled. "If there's parole in the afterlife, sweet love, I promise to be on my best behavior to get from where I'm going to where you've surely ended up. And thank Volka. What he did for us should put him at the feet of God himself." Several times during the journey, Peggy bumped into Private George, though the two of them didn't speak, other than to say excuse me when they passed in a snug corridor. Though they had been able to get out of Russia, that was not to say there weren't spies on the train who might not have a good description of them, and would be looking at couples or watching men and women traveling separately. For that reason, Peggy spent as much time as possible hovering around a group of Russian soldiers in the lounge car, contributing comments now and then to suggest that she was one of them, and even allowing one of them to come on to her, to give her a guardian angel if she needed one. Upon reaching Finland, shortly before dawn, she gave the soldier a false phone number and address, as the two passed through customs. A verbal declaration was sufficient to get Peggy through, though the Russians were treated to a thorough hand-luggage search. Peggy and Private George fell in side by side as they walked briskly into the street. The Englishwoman squinted into the sun as it poked its orange crown into the new day. "What the hell happened back at the museum?" George asked. Peggy smiled. "I forgot. You didn't know." "No, I didn't. I kept imagining that scene in The Guns of Navarone, where the woman spy bought it. I pretended to trip down the stairs, Peggy said. When the woman showed her hand by running after me, I had to cancel her. I used her gun on the Spetsnaz officer, who seemed to feel that he could take a few bullets and still wring my little neck. He couldn't. There was a lot of confusion after that, and I just slipped out.
"They'll never make a movie out of your life," George said. "No one'd believe this."
"Life is always more interesting than the movies," Peggy said. "That's why they have to make the damn things 40 feet high." The two chattered about possible departure plans, George deciding that he'd take the next flight he could get on, Peggy saying that she wasn't sure how or when she was going to leave Helsinki, that all she wanted to do right now was to walk and feel the sun bake her face, and avoid any closed space that reminded her of a midget submarine, the back seat of a car, or a cramped train. The two stopped walking in front of the Finnish National Theater. They looked at one another with warm smiles and soft eyes.
"I confess I was wrong," Peggy said. "I didn't think you'd be up to this."
"Thanks," George replied. "That's encouraging coming from someone with so much more experience, someone so much older."
Peggy was tempted to throw him on his back the way she had when they first met. Instead, she offered him her hand.
"The face of an angel and the soul of an imp," she said. "It's a good combination, and you carry them well. I hope to see you again."
"Ditto," he said.
She half turned, stopped.
"When you see him," she said, "the chap who grudgingly allowed me to join you, thank him."
"The team leader?" George asked.
"No," said Peggy. "Mike. He gave me a chance to take back some of what I lost."
"I'll tell him," George promised.
And turning to the sun like a moth to flame, Peggy walked down the empty street. Chapter 77. Friday, 8 a.m., Washington, D.C. An overnight rain had left the runway at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, damp and misty, reflecting the mood of the small group that had gathered to meet the C-141 transport. Standing beside an immaculate honor guard, Paul Hood, Mike Rogers, Melissa Squires, and the Squires' son Billy were of one heart, and that heart was bleeding. When they had arrived in the limousine following the hearse, Rogers had thought that he should remain strong for Billy. But now he realized that apart from being unnatural, it was impossible. When the cargo hatch was opened and the flag-draped coffin was rolled out, tears warmed Roger's cheeks, and he was as much a boy as Billy, anguished and in need of comfort, and despairing that there was none to be had. The general stood at attention, enduring as best he could the sobs of Lieutenant Colonel Squire's widow and son to his left. He was glad when Hood came from his right to stand behind the couple, the hem of his trench coat billowing slightly in the wind, his hands on their shoulders, ready to offer words or support or strength or whatever was necessary. And Rogers thought, "How I have misjudged this man." The honor guard fired off their guns, and as the coffin was loaded onto the hearse for the ride to Arlington, and the four of them stood alongside it, the spindly 5-year-old Billy suddenly turned to Rogers.
"Do you think my daddy was afraid when he was on the train?" he asked in his pure little boy voice.
Rogers had to roll his lips together to keep from losing it. As the boy's big eyes waited, it was Hood who squatted in front of him and answered.
"Your dad was like a police officer or a firefighter," Hood said. "Even though they're all afraid when they face a criminal or a fire, they want to help people, and so they pull bravery out of here."
He touched a finger to the lapel of Billy's blazer right over his heart.
"How do they do that?"
the boy asked, sniffling but attentive.
"I'm not sure," Hood replied. "They do it in a way that heroes do."
"Then my daddy was a hero?"
asked the boy, obviously pleased with the idea.
"A great one," said Hood. "A superhero."
"Bigger than you, General Rogers?"
"Very much bigger," Rogers said.
Melissa put an arm around Billy's shoulder, and managing a grateful smile at Hood, ushered him into the limousine. Rogers watched Melissa as she climbed in, then he looked at Hood.
"I have read,"
he started, stopped, then swallowed hard before he began again.
"I have read the greatest speeches and writings in human history.
but nothing ever moved me the way you just did, Paul. I want you to know that I'm proud to know you, and what's more, I'm proud to be serving under you."
Rogers saluted Hood and climbed into the car. Because his eyes were on Billy, the general didn't see Hood wipe away a tear as he followed him in. Chapter 78, The Last Chapter. The following Tuesday, 11:30 a.m., St. Petersburg. Paul Hood, his wife and their two children took a long walk in the park off the Nevsky Prospect before separating, Sharon and the children to watch a group of schoolchildren play soccer, Hood to sit on a bench by an ancient tree where a short man, in a leather flight jacket, was feeding breadcrumbs to the birds.
"It's odd to think," said the man in clear, comfortable English, "that creatures of the sky must come to earth to feed and build nests and raise families."
He swept a hand across the sky.
"You'd think there would be a place for them up there."
Hood smiled. "From up there, they get a special perspective on things down here. And that's quite a lot, I think." He looked at the man.
"Don't you, General Orloff?"
The former cosmonaut scrunched up his lower lip and nodded.
"It is at that."
He looked at the new arrival.
"How are you, my friend?"
"Very well," said Hood. Orloff pointed across the park with a half-torn piece of bread.
"You brought your family, I see."
"Well," said Hood, "I sort of owed them the rest of a vacation. This seemed like a very good place to take it." Orloff nodded.
"There is no place like St. Petersburg. Even when it was Leningrad, it was the jewel of the Soviet Union."
Hood's smile warmed. "I'm glad you agreed to see me. That makes this doubly rich." Orloff looked down at the bread and finished tearing it up. He scattered the pieces and brushed off his hands.
"We have both had quite an extraordinary week. We thwarted a coup, stopped a war, and we have each had a funeral. Yours of a friend, mine of an enemy. But both of them ends that came too soon."
Hood looked away and sniffed down still fresh sorrow.
"At least your son is well," he said. "That's helped to make this endurable. Perhaps all of it will have been for something." "With luck, that will be so," Orloff agreed. "My son is recovering at our apartment here in the city, and we'll have several weeks to talk and mend old hurts. I think he'll be more receptive to me than in the past, what with the wounding of his Spetsnaz mentor and the court-martial of Generals Kosygin and Mavik. I hope he'll see that it takes very little courage to run with vandals."
Olaf reached into his jacket.
"There's something else, I hope,"
he said as he pulled out a slim old book bound in leather and stamped on the cover and spine with gold lettering. He handed it to Hood.
"What is it?" Hood asked. "Sotko," said Orloff. "It's an old copy. For your second in command. I've ordered fresh editions to be distributed among the troops here in St. Petersburg. I read it myself and found it quite stirring. It's odd that an American should be the one to point out to us the richness of our own culture."
"Perspective," Hood repeated. "Sometimes it's good to be a bird, sometimes it's good to be on the ground."
"Truly," said Orloff. "I've learned a great deal from all of this. When I accepted this post, I thought, perhaps you did the same, that I would spend my time the way a supply officer does, feeling intelligence needs for others. But I realize now that it's our responsibility to put these resources to good use. Indeed, when my son returns to duty, I'm going to assign him to a special force whose job will be to hunt down that monster Shovich. I'm hoping, in fact, that our two operations centers can collaborate on that."
Hood said, "It would be an honor, General." Orloff looked at his watch.
"Speaking of my son, I'm joining him and my wife Masha for lunch. We haven't done that since I was flying rockets. and I'm looking forward to it very much.
He rose, and Hood did likewise. Just keep your expectations on the ground, Hood said. Nikita, Zhanyin, you and I, we're all just people. No more, no less.
Olaf clasped his hands warmly. My expectations will always be up there,
Olaf pointed by raising his brow. Then he looked past Hood and smiled.
And despite what you may feel, teach your son and daughter to do likewise. You may be surprised at how things work out.
Hood watched as Olaf left, then turned and glanced toward the corner of the park where Alexander and Harley had been. He saw Sharon standing alone, and he had to search for a moment before he spotted his children. They were playing soccer with the Russian youths.
I may be at that, Hood said aloud.
Pushing his hands in his pockets, he took a last look at Olaf, then walked with a light step and lighter heart to his wife's side. This concludes the reading of Op Center, Mirror Image, created by Tom Clancy and Steve Pachenik, written by Jeff Roven. Copyright 1995 by Jack Ryan Limited Partnership and SNR Literary Incorporated. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Jack Ryan Limited Partnership via Artists Management Group and was produced in 2002 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. This book was read by Michael Kramer.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.